I moved back to Montreal in the summer of 1987, and that was a few months before CQUT went FM on the air. It was I don't know what the license was before that, but I know that the one license that was available was both CRSG and CQUT had applied. CRSG was at Concordia. CQUT got the license, which was a bit controversial at the time. I came in not knowing really the controversy, but I came in having done some radio at CKCU in Ottawa for 3 or 4 years as a volunteer. And then I had lived in Geneva, Switzerland for a year, 86, 87, and I had done radio there in a formerly pirate station right across the border in France called Radio Zone. So I already had the radio bug and moved from Montreal with some friends from Ottawa. I had lived in Montreal during high school, and as soon as I moved back, I got involved at CQUT and I got a position as the, I think, assistant music program director for about a few months. During the process, when we went, we meaning CQUT, went on the air in November of 1987. And I eventually became the music program director, I think about maybe in 88 at some point. And I did that for 3 years. And then I took a break. Then I took on the position of production coordinator. So at the same time, I did my own show where I started exploring radio art more and more in depth. When I was at CKCU in Ottawa, there was a program called No Wasted Words. And that was basically the production department time slot where you could do a collage, or it would be a pre-recorded show. And that's where I learned how to edit tape. And I had done one of those slots. At the same time, I had done a show called Tapeworms, which I co-hosted. And it was a show featuring the cassette underground, which was really very strong in the 80s. So I had been exposed to a lot of experimental music, and I had done a few experiments while I was doing a kind of pretty standard radio show, meaning that I was, you know, sometimes playing the same two copies of the same record at the same time just to see how they would go in and out of phase. And those were very simple gestures. But when I came to CQUT, the show I was doing was called Danger in Paradise, and the way I had initially pitched it was as a show that was about anything but college rock, or, you know, quote unquote, alternative rock music. Not that I didn't like that, but I wanted to kind of offer an alternative to that musically. Even then, I don't know exactly how I got drawn in that direction, but I quickly realized that what interested me was less and less about kind of passively presenting, you know, music that I loved, and the information about this music and these composers and artists. But I wanted to play with the medium of radio itself. And that got translated into many, many different experiments. And as I also developed a kind of an audience for that, they responded. So there was a lot of experiments with phone-in. And I also started to find out that at other radio stations like CKLN in Toronto, CITR in Vancouver, and quite a few of the radio stations across the country had at least one radio art type programs. So people who were doing similar types of experiments, and each in their own style, but there was kind of the common element was that the normal procedure of using radio as a vehicle for communication was not really enough, or was not really the primary goal of what radio art was. And radio art is using the medium of radio as you would, you know, with a painting or a sculpture, and kind of playing around with a medium, which is not that self-evident, but I think it can be done and it continues to be done. One example that I think sticks to mind and is still one of my favorite moments was a show where I had, this was just before cell phone days, so the cell phones were not ubiquitous. This was early 90s. The premise of the show, for the 2 hours of the show, is that at the beginning, in this particular week, I told the listeners, I'm going to leave the phone booth, and I'm going to walk around Montreal, and I'm going to stop at every phone booth and call in as if I was not the host, but a listener. And I'm going to ask you to tell me where to walk. Should I go north, south, east, west? And I had asked a friend to be a silent kind of, he would just put on, anybody who called would be on the air automatically without, it's not like a AM radio call-in show where you're, you know, asked to comment about a particular political topic. So what was really wonderful about that moment was that tons of people called, and there were moments I had a little radio receiver so I could listen to the show as I was walking. There were moments where nothing was happening. There were moments where listeners were on the air, but I wasn't on the air with them. And they would talk to each other, because I think I could put up to two people on at the same time. And, you know, people were wondering out loud, well, where is he? I also invited other people to walk and do the same thing as I was doing. So there was a lot of layering of this kind of radio mapping and a very unpredictable progression. The accent, too, was performance in a very broad sense of the term, but on liveness, on kind of very something very immediate. There was a similar show that I did with Julia Loktev, who had the time slot right after me, I believe, for a little while. And we did a show called Body Map, where it was somewhat of a similar premise in terms of mapping. But we took the island of Montreal and we pretended that it was a body, a reclining body. And then people would call in, they would tell us where they were, where they lived. And we would tell them on what part of the body they were, you know, in the intestine or in the lungs or in the heart. And if they were lived on a major street, they were living on an artery and vein. So we did this kind of transposition, which was, you know, quite playful and simple in a way, but I think people really responded well to that kind of prompt. In my capacity as the production coordinator, I was one of the main people involved in training people on how to use the equipment. And part and parcel of that was, well, obviously to give access to whoever was interested. But I tried, especially for people who were particularly keen or people who wanted to kind of go beyond the basics, to really explore the possibilities of either the on-air studio or the production studio. And I was, you know, just a few steps ahead in the sense that I had acquired some skills but basically I guess the gist of what I'm trying to say is that I learned a lot about teaching at CKUT, and, you know, I'm a full-time professor now at the university, and there's lots of things that I can trace back to those early days at CKUT in terms of teaching and how to ensure that the person that you're teaching is also kind of engaged and to be attentive to their, you know, each person has their particular need and sometimes blockages. So that was a great learning experience. In production, there was, I think, a very similar ethos of wanting to, you know, do any of the ads, kind of promo spots that we were tasked to do. You know, you always have the kind of the task is to convey the information of what the event is, but given that oftentimes the event is in a like-minded location with like-minded artists, and by like-mind I mean that, you know, people who are willing to experiment or are interested in playing around with sonic material, that was the impetus for us to create situations in the production studio that was not just a voiceover over the music of the band that is going to play, you know, in 2 weeks at Fufun Electrique or something like that. It's not always possible depending on the deadline, but in the collaboration was mostly through the fact that on a daily basis, when you're around CKUT or any radio station like that, for that matter, during the day, there's always people going in and out. So I would just grab people if there was, you know, right after their show or right before, or they're prepping for something else. And I would say, you know, put them in the studio in front of the microphone and say, read this. Or I would talk to them in a talkback mic and say, what do you think about that? And then I would use whatever their response was to cut it up. Most of the people were quite game in playing or kind of got the gist of what I was searching for. There's one instance where leftover object or some kind of tool in the production studio, I had no idea what it was, but I put it up on the table in the recording studio, and then I just had at least a dozen people go in, use the object, which kind of squeaked and make a noise, and recorded people as they were wondering what it was. And it was quite a nice way to then play back on the radio, and you have this object that the listener is not seeing, but you're hearing through people exploring the object physically. You're hearing it, like you're seeing what's created is a portrait of this object, even though you'll never get to see nor have any idea of what it is. For a little while in the early days of the program that featured new releases, which is called New Shit, which I think is still exists, I did a little capsule for about 5 or 10 minutes called Margot's Intense Listening Corner. And so Margot Beauregard, who I think just recently retired from CKUT, who was a fixture at CKUT for many, many years, what I would do is I would take some music and I would play them to her over her headphones, and then I would record her reactions. And that Margot's Intense Listening Corner was just a playback of her reactions. You didn't really hear the music. So I remember playing back the first De La Soul album, 3 Feet High and Rising, and her reaction was really priceless. You could hear a bit of the music filtering through her headphones because it was up quite loud, but she's so immediate and unfiltered and genuine and exuberant about her reactions that it made for, I think, a really nice way to kind of convey this appreciation for music in a very visceral way. There was a lot of late nights too, lots of loops with tapes running around different tape recorders around the room. I mean, in retrospect, the pre-digital days were very laborious. It took a long, long time to produce, you know, a 15-second spot. Roland Simmons was the person when we went on FM who had really acquired all the equipment. He had graduated from Fanshawe College. So it was quite a well-equipped production studio in terms of the mixer, the kinds of microphones. There were some effects. There was an 8-track machine and two quarter-inch reel-to-reel machines. So it was a fairly steep learning curve because that was one of the downsides, is that it quite often the on-air studio and the production studio will have basically the same equipment. So you could, you know, go on air, one is the backup to the other. In this case, the production studio was very, very different. So there was no replication, and that was one downside of acquiring that more high-end equipment that I think would be normally used in that context. But what it did offer is a lot more possibilities. So especially the 8-track, and I think part of the idea of the 8-track is that you could produce some bands, which I don't think ever really happened in the same way that you would, you know, in a recording studio where you could do some record separate tracks and so on. Mm-hmm. Quite a few bands came in and played there, but it was, you know, all live with couple of microphones. We weren't producing demos or anything in that studio. The studio was way too busy anyway to be able to allow for that. And this was also when CKUT was in a different building than it is now. It was in the what is now the William Shatner building in the basement. So it was quite cramped, windowless, days upon days, years upon years, in those early days. During one of the NCRA conferences that CKUT hosted, I think it was 1991, Julia Loktev, Brian Zura, and myself organized a set of radio art events called Radio Contortions. We cleared out the entire record library that was immediately outside of the on-air studio, and we had a set of live events. One of them was Nancy Stedman and Julia Loktev piece. I forget the title of it, but it was basically a dinner on the air for about 10 people where everyone was blindfolded. So, and what was going on the air was basically people's reactions to their food. It was very lively and as to be expected. Nancy Stedman is a magnificent chef, so she tailored her, you know, the menu to really surprise people who, you know, she did concocted it with the knowledge that people would not be able to see their food. I wouldn't say that, you know, analog versus digital has a real consequence on the whether it's a solitary pursuit or a collaborative one, because I can think of examples in or kind of methods of working in both. You know, I think given that analog tends to be slower, take a lot more time to produce something compared to if you were doing the same thing digital, sometimes it can get quite impatient. And if you're cutting up tape, it is that aspect of editing, it's hard to share that task. So in a sense, I believe in the model where I think on a practical basis in terms of production, meaning that it's hard to share the producer's hat. Especially if you're trying to kind of execute or concretize an idea that you have in your head, but it's not quite easy to communicate it. You just have to experiment and do it. So in terms of the concrete aspect of working on a piece, collaboration is maybe less evident. There was one set of shows that we did. There was a radio soap opera called Squeaky Clean. I think there was about 12 episodes that Sarah Toy and myself did most of the episodes. Hani Habashi did one. I think Genevieve Heistek did one. And we put that out as a cassette. But all of those were produced in the production studio at CQT. And that was a good example of a collaboration where there were single authored or single people kind of responsible for each episode, but we appeared as voices on each other's episodes, and there was a kind of a nice continuity. It was very unscripted, but we kind of pretended that this was a soap opera, and so we made some references to the conventions of soap opera. I did a couple of things with pirate radio on CKUT. One of them, Amanda Aronchik and myself brought in Tetsuo Kogawa, who's a legendary Japanese activist for pirate radio. Did a workshop where he taught us, a bunch of people who were there, he taught us how to make a 1-watt transmitter. And he had a little kit. On my show, On Danger in Paradise, what I did is, I think I was trying to replicate that moment or that workshop by making a 1-1 radio while I was on the air. So I was just talking through the steps of, okay, now you put a transistor here and you put a bit of solder. So it was a talking through of the making of, I was transmitting the act of making a transmitter There's something about that kind of a mise en abîme that I quite enjoyed. In 1992, I went to the Banff Center for the Arts for the first time, and there was an event called Radio Rethink. And the Banff Center had a radio station at the time, very low watt, and I think it was pirate. I'm pretty sure it was not official. That's where I first met Tetsuo Okogawa. I think he must have come to CQT in Montreal a year after, 93 perhaps. As far as I know, the one that I had made with Tetsuo Okogawa, I had a transmitter that once in a while I used, and then I had another one that was a kit that you could buy, that you could make. So I did some performances in Montreal using these pirate transmitters for a couple of events in galleries. So I would use the transmitters to, you know, wirelessly play back this recording to somewhere else in the space. They were quite unreliable, but the low quality was an interesting aspect as well. André-Éric Letourneau of Système Minuit, who did for a long time a show at CQUT as well, he did quite a few projects with pirate radio as well. There was one that I remember at Articule where I did a performance as well using my own transmitters. All this to say that there was quite a few people who had these little transmitters. You couldn't do that much with them because, you know, they couldn't really go through walls. They couldn't go very far. Radio was, especially the moments where I was doing my show, was a moment of kind of testing my relationship to an audience, and how, you know, you could be playful or you could be very intimate. But yet, given the medium of radio, you could retain some level of anonymity and kind of a safety zone. And that was very helpful, so that when I shifted to doing things more in front of an audience who were in the same space as myself, while it's still, you know, nerve-wracking and you're in a vulnerable position, I think the influence of having done that on radio for many years, I guess, gave me a certain confidence and a certain interest in kind of not returning to that moment, but a realization that encounter of the live moment, be it on the radio or in front of an audience in the same space, you know, let's say at the Sala Rosa or even if you're doing an artist talk in a conference, whatever the context is, that engagement where you are presenting a proposition via your artwork is a privileged moment where there's a certain responsibility attached to it. If you are the kind of person who is producing work, I think there's nothing wrong with keeping those things to yourself and you know, there's lots of instances of people who have extensive art practices and you only discover them after they pass away. For me, I see that as a collaboration where I'm always interested in whatever I'm producing or involved in to test it out, to, you know, present it as a proposition to somebody or a set of people and say, okay, well, what do you think? And to understand that asking that, even if it's an implicit ask, is a gesture of openness. I mean, you're asking a lot for the response, and sometimes you don't get a response, and that's also a kind of response. But I think basically art is that in between. At least for me, it's really about that engagement and the unpredictable nature of what kind of response you're going to get. And I should say, it's not just about showing your work, and that's, I think, a big part and parcel for me of my time at CQUT is I've done a lot of curatorial work as well, where I'm, you know, inviting artists to present their work, and that for me is just as important an aspect of my overall kind of practice, is to provide opportunities for people and see how they themselves engage, but also, you know, let's say if I'm presenting a show with 8 different artists that I've assembled, there's something about quite creative in the task of weaving together a collaboration through these eight people, or conversation through the overall curatorial vision. In the late 90s, I did a piece called Crackers, and that's a CD that came out in 2001, entirely composed of people cracking their joints, be it their hands, neck, elbows, knees, hips, backs. And so it's quite coherent in that way, or narrow in terms of the range of sounds. I've done that project in two different cities, Ottawa and Halifax, and I frame it as a kind of a nervous portrait of a city. In the first time I did it, it was in Ottawa, and we advertised it on CKCU, actually, in the newspaper. And 11 people showed up. This was through a residency at Gallery 101. And then I recorded them, and the recording moment was quite interesting because I didn't think, honestly, that I would be able to capture the sounds of cracking. It seemed too hollow and dry, and I was skeptical that I would be able to capture the sounds, especially since I wasn't in a proper sound studio. But the recordings turned out quite well, and the kind of dance between the person cracking and myself is something that I really treasure, because I didn't really expect it. But people would tell me, oh, you know, place your microphone here, but not here, because I'm going to swing around so that I can crack my back. And I wish I had videotaped that, because it was a nice, intimate moment where these two people are trying to accomplish this thing of recording, you know, one of the two people's bodies producing sound. I think there's about 9 pieces on the CD, and one of them is quite referential, meaning it's a little excerpt from the encounter with one of the people cracking, so that people get a glimpse of the recording session. And then through all the different tracks on this full-length CD, it's quite monochromatic in a way, in the sense that each kind of creates a different world. One of the tracks is quite percussive, and it's probably the closest to the original recordings. And it was, you know, kind of recorded in such a way that there's lots of pops, and some of them are more bassy, and some of them are quite small and tiny. Other ones, there was one, the first track, I believe, on the CD it's also based on just an edited version of all the cracks, but I really treated the sounds through various runs at EQing to really focus only on the high end. And because I did several passes on Pro Tools, a lot of them became kind of tones and much more abstract. So I often played back this piece when I'm doing an artist talk, and without introducing the context, and people think, oh, this is kind of a very minimal electronic music. But then when I explain the source, I can always see at least a few faces cringe, because then they start imagining the body that produced these sounds, or bodies that produced these sounds. And then other tracks, I would not, because it was a full CD, I felt that with some of the other tracks, I could go farther and abstract the sound even more. So it became much more about creating a drone. And in the way I usually work in Pro Tools is that I have some plugins, and I, through trial and error, it's not like I have a plan of what I want it to sound. I just spend a lot of time with the sound, playing back and trying different plugins. I have, you know, some of them that I prefer over others, but and it's about kind of immersing yourself in the material and kind of trusting your ears that, oh, because in many ways you are your own first listener. So if I start liking a sound, and that's the direction I'm going to push it. So it's quite subjective in that way, but it's not planned. So I wouldn't say it's really composed. I would say it's maybe arranged, which mm-hmm. I guess also has a musical connotation, but somewhat in the same vein, in that the sources are produced by a bunch of people that I invited. It was called Poker, And you'll start to see a common thread that I often use the body, and especially, you know, when you think of sound art, you think, well, if it's a body involved, and what produces sound in a body, primary vehicle for sound in a person is the voice. And I've done projects like that with the voice, but for quite a few of my pieces, I wanted to try to see what other parts of the body, what are their potential for sound. So with poker, for instance, I invited people. This was the summer, I think, of 2001 or so, 2000 in Montreal. I would invite them to where I was living and film them with a close-up of their face. And I was behind the camera, and I would play their face with different kinds of contact microphones. So if it was a man with a stubble, then that makes a certain kind of predictable scratchy sound. And the word poker means literally I'm poking them. But also I had asked all of those people to be poker-faced, meaning that I was the person who was going to create the expression in their faces. I mean, some people couldn't help them because as I was poking them, they would either get twitchy or tickly or kind of realize the absurdity of what I was doing to them. But that ended up being a nine-minute video or so where eventually I also treated the sounds, but the video compilation of their faces became a video piece that I presented quite a few times live, where I would also, as it was playing back, I would play my own face as an a live element to accompany the video piece. And another one that came in maybe a couple of years before called Evasion, it might be an interesting kind of bridge between my performance work and radio, because this was one of the first Squint Fucker Press events. It was a space on Saint Laurent, which doesn't exist anymore, a loft. And it was recorded by Radio Canada for Le Navire Night, which is a program that doesn't exist anymore. But I think five or six people performed. And the piece I did for that event, the piece called Evasion, is I stick out my tongue as far as I can for as long as I can. So I went in front of an audience, in front of a microphone, with the knowledge that Radio Canada is recording this for a radio program that was going to be aired a couple of weeks after, I think. And I stuck out my tongue, and it lasted about 9 minutes, which, you know, if you try, is quite a long time to do that. I didn't really know what would happen, nor how long I would last, but eventually, as people get what I'm doing or get that that's the only thing I'm doing, then they react and they become part of the piece. And that was a big aspect of that piece. And so basically, it's a relatively soundless piece as far as, you know, what my body is producing. The full title of that piece is Evasion, or How to Perform a Tongue Escape in Public. So it kind of connects to what I was just saying earlier about, especially with radio, if for me doing radio art was trying to bypass this aspect of radio that is communication, which is in which the vehicle is mostly the voice saying words. So one way to bypass that in a very simple way is to still reference the voice, and especially the physical ways that the voice are produced, so the tongue, the throat, the mouth cavity, etc., the saliva, and to try to work with those elements. And sometimes, working with them means not producing any sound, or at least producing very micro, minute sound. Le Printemps Électroacoustique, so ACREC was involved in that. I think it was 1992, or early 90s for sure. Claude Schreier, who was involved in a radio program at CQT and presently works at the Canada Council for the Arts in Ottawa. Him and I, we co-curated a series of basically the CQT contributions to that event, which was quite large and had installations in Parc La Fontaine and had concerts and stuff happening on Radio Canada. But our contribution was we commissioned a series of works for the sunrise and for the sunset, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe it was only one of the two. But anyway, they were slotted at that as precise as we can get. So it would interrupt whatever program was happening at those two moments. And the Printemps Electroacoustique, the focus of that was really on acoustic ecology, which was definitely more practice involved. It was much more invested in that. But I like the sunrise-sunset angle because it connects you right away to, you know, what's happening right outside your door, an event that obviously we can't control. And I'm not sure if that was the same event or another one, but there was a series that we did called Neighborhood Sounds. Yeah, I'm not sure if I was the only curator of that or somebody else was involved at that level. But those were carts. I think there's a dozen people that did carts for that. The one I always remember and that sometimes I play in my classes was by Susan Epps. It was called Streets of Recovery. So we had made a cart inviting people to contribute their neighborhood sounds. What were their sounds of their neighborhood? And what she did, she lived on the plateau. This was a middle-aged woman who had no radio experience, but she went to a phone booth and called her own answering machine. And she gave a kind of narrative of how she was involved in all these different 12-step programs. There was codependency, there was a whole array of kind of the predictable 12-step programs, but she was saying that how those communities, those were her neighborhoods. And then she was also talking about the fact that, well, here I am in this phone booth and I'm worried that my answering machine is going to beep any moment. Again, this is pre-digital when people's answering machines were these small little cassettes. But anyway, that's what she ended up sending to us, is this little cassette with that recording. It was a beautiful, a wonderful way to reach out to this member of the public and to incite this person to contribute to her angle. A part of my reasoning or my interest in exploring radio through the listeners, by involving the listeners in a very concrete way and repeatedly, I was inspired by something that Bertolt Brecht said, where he critiqued of fascism by saying that, as a lot of people know, radio was used as a vehicle to communicate Hitler's speeches. So it can have this aspect of the voice of authority. So Bertolt Brecht talks about radio as being this unfinished invention, where his imagining of radio, the way that he thought it as a more kind of egalitarian technology, was to have the listeners being on equal level as the person behind the microphone. So an obvious way of translating that is to basically put the listener on the microphone, or to give them, you know, access to the airwaves. And of course, AM radio does that a lot with talk shows. And, you know, nowadays you have social media that arguably provides the same kind of platform. And there's, you know, good and bad aspects to that. And obviously there's that opening up also enables moments of abuse or hatred, or to be given a platform. So, you know, the issue of free speech is not that far from that, the spirit of opening it up, but it doesn't negate, I think, the benefit of different attempts to see what happens when, I guess the gist of what I'm saying is that it's worth trying, despite the fact that, I mean, it's not a utopia. It's always going to be adjustments needed, or ways to, I was going to say control, but I'm trying to avoid the word control, mm-hmm. by kind of steer the conversation or create a kind of environment that is not going to exclude everyone, but also people who are going to not Well, I think in my particular case, in Danger in Paradise, I had the same time slot on Wednesday night, 10 to midnight, for quite a few years. And I had quite a, I couldn't put a number to it, but I had a lot of people who called in regularly. And even on the weeks where I didn't have a kind of call-in type of format, you know, they would call in saying, oh, you know, how come you're not doing anything experimental this week? Or, and because they were kind of itching to contribute to the game. And I think, I mean, there was lots of times where I think it didn't work, but I'm interested in failure too. Especially if they create moments where, you know, nothing's happening on the air. Because I, as somebody who was a member of the staff at CQUT, one of the aspects of radio that really drove me crazy is this self-imposed obligation to always fill the air. So at least in my two-hour time slot, I tried to sometimes enact the possibility of not filling the air. In fact, I remember one day where I was really exhausted. So I went on the air and I kind of reclined and I put the microphone on my chest and said, well, at the beginning of the show, I'm really tired now. I'm going to go to sleep. So I went to sleep. The microphone was live, and I was doing my show by not doing anything. Yeah, I mean, it often times can be hit and or miss, in the sense that when you open up the floor, so to speak, to anyone to say anything, then that's what you'll get. You'll get anything and everything and nothing. So I think the challenge and where kind of the art is to try to present, to frame it, to have some sense of direction or purpose, without that translating necessarily as overt control. I mean, John Cage is an interesting figure in that sense. I mean, it's somebody who I knew of at the time, but not as deeply as now, and especially in this aspect of being a composer who is trying to, who still, you know, calls himself a composer, but he's using techniques by way of removing as much as possible his own biases. And I think it's, I mean, ultimately he's, you know, he's still the person behind the throwing of the I Ching and these chance operations. He's still the person making decisions of when to invoke that, to use that technique. So I think, especially in a post-Cage context, I think the acknowledgement that there's still an element of control, it might be a bit more removed or kind of more subtle, but more self-aware, I think that's already a step in the right direction. Experimental music, I think when I started doing radio, this was at CKCU in Ottawa at the beginning of my undergraduate years at Carleton. So this was 1983 or 4. You suddenly have access to this incredible record library, and once you get on the air, at least there you would have to do an overnight slot, so it's about 6 hours, and so you quickly exhaust what you know and have to really, you know, plunge into things that you don't know. And that really opened up what I knew before, which was, you know, based on what I heard on the radio. And I wouldn't say I was knowledgeable about music beforehand at all, but that was a very quick and intense immersion into the world of music. And this was, you know, not really the first wave of punk, but maybe the second wave already. But definitely what was happening was quite strong, and a big influence on me was the hardcore movement, especially its political side with Crass. And it was local Ottawa bands that were really influenced by Crass and politics around that. And some of the music that they produced was quite experimental. So in knowing that you know, this is out there, and starting to learn about John Cage, about the avant-garde movements of the early 20th century, which some of them involved sound, like sound poetry at the Cabaret Voltaire, seeing some of those types of bands come through and tour and seeing them live, trying to see the connections to, you know, kind of the fringes of jazz as well, thinking of Sun Ra especially was a big influence for me. And all this kind of immersion without me being a musician at all. So it seemed that as I started to produce sound, I mean, obviously it was through radio, but when I kind of left my direct connection to radio and started doing things live, some of them were strict kind of more performance art things, but when they were connected to live sound producing, I had to develop as they would say in French, a lutherie, or kind of a set of tools that would enable me to produce sounds live. So I've been using a gutted reel-to-reel for many years, and I use contact microphones to play the motors, and it's a very noisy affair. And I have an ongoing collaboration with Alexandre Saint-Onge on the duo called Undo, which is very sporadic, but experimental music has that, and maybe I wouldn't even call it music, but I mean, I'm not even concerned about the genre or label. It's just when, and since I've been active, you know, I guess close to 20 years, if not more, I mean, there were definitely people doing it way earlier than me, but now it seems so, I wouldn't say ubiquitous, but there's so much activity by all kinds of generations. Thankfully, in terms of gender, it's a lot better than it used to be. There's still a lot of work to do in that direction. And there's many kind of communities, and some of them are connected to, you know, much more of a electronic or dance oriented thing. Some are connected to some much more strictly or narrow definition of noise. There's all sorts of sub genres in there, which I think is great. I mean, I don't feel restricted or aligned with any particular one. But I think it was Gordon Monahan who prefers using the word experimental and not music, just say experimental, which I kind of like that move of placing the importance on the act of experimenting, no matter what, no matter how it manifests. It's more of an attitudinal perspective than saying it's experimental jazz or experimental, you know, like kind of finishing the sentence, leaving it focused on the word experimental. I think the key piece for me that I keep coming back to, not even sure when I first heard it, but for me it's Alvin Lucier's I'm Sitting in a Room, and it kind of incorporates a lot of my interests and concerns in terms of paying attention to a space, a self-awareness of presence in the space, interest in language, repetition, duration. That would be, you know, very high on top of the list. So it's definitely not a song, but there's kind of musical aspects to it, but it's a key work for me.